tune in to Turn on the News daily from 313.9.org. You can go to newsroom.313.9.org for links to anything you might hear here, including links to international radio art, radio news, media news, links, and more. Go to 313.9 and newsroom.313.9.org for everything you want to know about transmission arts. And to hear Turn on the News daily. Today we're tuning into globalrevolution.com. We're tuning into web streams here and there and everywhere. If you tuned into the internet last weekend, you could have heard protests in Chicago, Montreal, New York. You could have heard rallies in Wisconsin, web streams from noise festivals. The media opportunities now are fairly endless. Here's Chicago from Global Revolution. This is from Monday, May 21st. In Chicago, at least four journalists were arrested. There's this now infamous recording of protesters, at least one being run over by a police van on the Jackson Street Bridge in Chicago. That was from the Jackson Street Bridge on Saturday 19th, one of the many live streams covering protests this weekend. And while there has been an explosion of different web streams available, there has also been a reaction to it. Sonia Rincon at 1010 Winds reports on a 40,000 Orthodox Jews that attended a rally at Citi Field in Queens, New York, against the internet.
The thousands of men and boys in traditional black suits arrived at the stadium hoping to learn what types of filters are available and approved for blocking anything potentially offensive. Chaim Lieber says he's improvised his own internet filters with the help of his service provider.
I can't really go onto any website I want to. Access denied on 99% of the website.
And that's the way you like it?
That's the way I like it, yes.
So that's one view. Another, from another point of view, is Dan Rather talking about the corrosion of the mainstream media with Bill Maher on his HBO show Real Time.
Basically, we were getting onto the subject of consolidation in the media. I mean, in 1983, when you were, I guess, hosting the CBS Evening News, there were 50 media companies. Now there's only six. They've been consolidated. And they are corporations, and corporations have a political agenda. I mean, they're anti-regulation, they're anti-tax, they're anti-labor. In that same period, we have seen regulations diminished, taxes go down, union membership go down. Is that a coincidence?
No, it's not a coincidence. One thing, in the 50s and into the early 60s, we had as many as 50 media outlets separately owned that could be said to have true national distribution or something close to it.
Mm-hmm.
So after that being a good down, but your point is well taken. It's one I think that whether you're a conservative or a liberal, a progressive, a Democrat, a Republican, everybody can be and should be concerned about this. The constant consolidation of media, particularly national distribution media, with a few companies, no more than six, my count is four, now control more than 80% of the true national distribution of news. Now, these large corporations, they have things they need from the power structure in Washington, whether it's Republican or Democrat. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the power in Washington have things they want the news to be reported. And to put it bluntly, very big business is in bed with very big government in Washington and has more to do with what the average person sees, hears, and reads than most people know. And that's one of the threads that I wanted in the book and tried to deal with the book.
18-year-old.
That was Dan Rather speaking with Bill Maher on his HBO show, Real Time with Bill Maher, on May 18th. So Dan Rather complains about fewer voices in the media, but they're, at the same time, the internet and digital replication have allowed many more voices, whether they be through YouTube or CBS. And even the government is providing some of the information. The Federal Communications Commission, for instance, streams many of their public meetings and workshops. May 22nd, the FCC will host the channel sharing workshop from 10 a.m. to 12 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time at FCC.gov. On May 21st, they held this meeting about the antenna structure regulations, the environmental regulations that mandate antennas be with for transmitting television radio stations meet certain environmental standards so that birds have less problems with them.
We on? Good. Welcome. This is our session to talk through the new ASR system for giving notice of environmental issues. If that's not what you're here for, find your right place. I do want to welcome everybody. Just a brief bit of background on what we're doing here. This system was introduced. It came out of the, originally out of the Gulf petition, where a number of environmental groups petitioned that for a number of actions that the commission should take on registered towers, focusing on the Gulf of Mexico, but the issues were really nationwide. And the court issued an order telling us that we had to change some things about our system. In particular, that led to the remand order that came down last December. And that addressed two things in particular. One of them is an interim rule to file environmental assessments for towers that are over 450 feet in height in order to address their potential impacts on migratory birds. And the other one is the requirement that all applications for antenna structure registration should be made available for the public to comment on them for a period in order to raise potential environmental issues. It was in response to that order from the court that the remand order came out in December laying out the details. Since that time, we've been getting approval under the Paperwork Reduction Act as well as doing the programming of the system. We now have OMB approval. We're expecting the system to come up very shortly and wanted to walk you through here, give folks a chance to understand what is this new system that you're going to need to use to provide the environmental notice.
May 23rd, 1934 was the day of birth of Robert Arthur Bob Moog. A pioneer of electronic music, best known for inventing the Moog synthesizer and being having his name mispronounced more than virtually any other human being. John Egerton at Broadcasting and Cable reports that Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa, slammed the FCC on the Senate floor yesterday, took the agency to task, quote, over the waiver it initially issued to LightSquared and over the documents it did not initially release about how the waiver was granted, unquote. Grassley recently lifted his hold on the nominations of FCC commissioners Ajit Pai and Jessica Rosenworcel. And we are going to play the 11-minute speech via C-SPAN in a few moments on Turn on the News. Stay tuned. In other news, Free Press Advocacy Group, Free Press, criticizes the move, by National Association of Broadcasters on Tuesday, May 22nd, to file a petition with the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals challenging the Federal Communications Commission's April order requiring broadcasters to put their political file information online. Free Press Senior Policy Counsel Corey Wright made the following statement, quote, This is nothing more than an attempt by the NAB to stall an important and overdue transparency initiative. The FCC decision to put the political files online will bring broadcasters into the 21st century and will make already public information more easily accessible to everyone. The FCC made the right decision and is on firm legal ground. All right, we're now picking up in the background Senator Grassley. So we're going to go straight to Senator Grassley's speech.
The senator from Iowa.
Thank you, Madam President. I'm pleased to see that Jessica Rosenworcel and Ajit Pai have been confirmed to the Federal Communications Commission. They're both highly qualified, and it's unfortunate that the FCC's stubborn refusal to respond to my very simple request for information forced me to place a hold on their nominations for the past 4 months in order to get the FCC to move on giving me the information that any member of Congress ought to be entitled to. The FCC needs to learn a simple lesson from this episode. The public's business ought to be public, and transparency brings accountability. Eventually, the truth will be known, so you might as well get it out there when the questions first come up. I initially placed my hold on the FCC commissioner nominees because the FCC had stonewalled a document request that I submitted on April the 27th last year regarding their actions related to a company called Light Squared and the hedge fund Harbinger Capital that owns Light Squared. Before I wrote my letter on Light Squared, many concerns had already been raised regarding the company's plans for a terrestrial network and its potential to interfere with the global positioning system, or sometimes that's referred to as GPS. In my first letter, I raised those concerns as well. Unfortunately, the FCC doesn't appear to have taken those concerns seriously, but months later, independent testing verified the danger Light Squared posed to industries from commercial aviation to even our own armed forces. It seems strange that a project that was so obviously flawed was allowed to go so far, but Light Squared had help. In total, Light Squared has paid 53 different lobbyists, some registered, some unregistered. They paid one former governor, three former senators, nine former members of Congress, including a former speaker and former minority leader, and a former White House counsel, to advocate for them that Light Squared ought to go through. These lobbyists provided entry into the FCC and the White House, but they couldn't change the fact that Light Squared's network simply couldn't coexist with GPS. Light Squared has now declared bankruptcy, and it appears that its plan to build a terrestrial network are over. But many questions still remain. Some of those questions: why did the FCC give Light Squared this unusual waiver in the first place? Why did Light Squared's lawyers mention campaign contributions when they sought meetings at the White House? Why did a four-star general claim he had been pressured by the Obama administration not to criticize Light Squared? When I first asked the FCC for documents, I was told that they would take about 2 years to respond to my request through Freedom of Information. Then they told me that they do not voluntarily turn over documents to the 99.6% of the members of Congress and senators who do not chair a committee with direct jurisdiction over FCC. After a lot of back and forth with the FCC, they told me the reason they don't respond to 99.6% of Congress is because of just a one-line statement in the Congressional Research Service report. The line reads, quote, "Oversight is most effective if it's conducted by congressional committees of jurisdiction," end of quote. Now, the FCC somehow took this quote and conveniently came up with the idea that they don't have to give this senator, and of course, to anybody in the Congress, this makes no sense whatsoever, but that's what the FCC hid behind. And of course, you know me, I didn't give up. The FCC's response to me is just another variation on what the Justice Department told me when I started asking questions about Operation Fast and Furious. Unfortunately, we have members of the House of Representatives that aren't afraid to ask this administration some tough questions. In Fast and Furious, it was Chairman Issa who held the Justice Department's feet to the fire to make sure that they responded fully and responded completely. When Light Squared, or with Light Squared, it was another committee in the House of Representatives, the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Chairman Walden, Upton, and Stearns and their staffs have done an excellent job in making sure the FCC is open, transparent, and provides documents to Congress, even when they don't want to give those documents to a senator that asked for them, meaning this senator. I would also like to thank Commerce Committee Chairman Rockefeller here in the Senate for pressing the FCC personally to release documents. With all this help, we're making sure that the FCC is open with the American people about the way they operate, because transparency brings accountability. In over 30 years of conducting oversight, I can say that when it comes to providing documents to the Congress, the FCC is one of the worst federal agencies that I've ever had to deal with. Even after receiving a document request from the Energy and Commerce Committee in the House of Representatives, the FCC still tried to play the tired old games that agencies play when they aren't acting in good faith. When they finally turned over their first batch of documents, would you believe it? Those documents were already publicly available on the Internet through Freedom of Information Act. So they weren't giving us any through Freedom of Information Act. So they weren't giving us anything that we didn't already have access to. Now, then there was when they didn't convince us that they were acting in good faith, because quite frankly they weren't, they gave us a second production. But even of the first 1,968 pages that they produced, all but three, in other words, 1,965 pages, were newspaper clippings. Again, the FCC was playing games. And of course, that's just not acceptable. Fortunately, we have continued to press the FCC, and we now, with the help of the House of Representatives, have approximately 8,000 non-public internal documents. Still, we have not received all responsive documents from the FCC yet. We just received another 4,000 pages of documents, and I've been told that approximately 7,000 more documents are on their way to Congress. So we now at least have a path forward. That is why I lifted my holds a couple weeks ago, so that these nominations could move forward. I trust that the House Committee will ensure that the FCC provides those 7,000 or so additional documents. I've always said that if you're hiding something, it's best to get it out in the open, because the longer you stonewall, meaning in this case the FCC, the worse you're going to look when those facts finally come out. The FCC has attempted to stonewall my request for documents for almost a year, and they have failed. But they failed only thanks to the help provided by the House Energy and Commerce Committee. And because of that help, we're finally able to review internal documents from the FCC, the very same documents we should have gotten when we first asked our request April 27th last year. As I said when I initially filed my intent to object, I strongly believe that it is critical for Congress to have access to documents in order to conduct vigorous and independent oversight. Whether it takes one day, one week, one month, or even one year, as it did in this case, I will continue to pursue transparency across the federal government because transparency brings accountability. This is essential so that Congress can practice its constitutional role of oversight over the federal government. The role of oversight is this simple. Congress passes laws and appropriates money. That's not the end of it. Our government is a government of checks and balances. We have a responsibility, after passing laws, after appropriating money, to make sure that the laws are faithfully executed and the money spent according to the intent of Congress. That's oversight. Even now, as we review these documents that we've already gotten and begin conducting interviews with key FCC staff, the investigation obviously continues. Step one was getting access to the FCC emails. It took this step so that we could make sure that we had the facts before we jumped to conclusions. Now it's time for step two, asking some hard questions of the key FCC personnel who approved the Light Squared waiver. This process may continue to take more time, but however long the process takes, I will continue to press for transparency at the FCC because with transparency comes accountability. This agency must operate in an open and transparent manner, and we must have answers regarding the Light Squared waiver. The people at the FCC work for the American people. They don't work for themselves. I yield the floor, and I suggest the absence of a quorum.
I'm Tom Rowe. You're listening to Turn on the News. It's Claude Dijon behind us from his Moog album, United We Stand. And we just were hearing from Republican from Iowa, Senator Chuck Grassley, on the U.S. Senate floor this on Tuesday, May 22nd, around 11 a.m. on the U.S. Senate floor, talking about how the FCC rubber-stamped or quickly approved the Light Squared Spectrum deal without proper approval, or well, he says there's technical problems with it, but he's looking for documents, and now he's got some of them. He let the FCC nominee go on. Meanwhile, the FCC had a channel sharing workshop on Tuesday, May 22nd, talking about how broadcasters can move from UHF to or VHF to UHF channels. Well, let's let Bill Lake, the chief of the FCC Media Bureau, explain.
I want to welcome you to this workshop on channel sharing in connection with the incentive auction for broadcast spectrum. This is the first in what we expect will be a series of workshops in which we'll invite input on issues to be explored as we move toward a proceeding to establish rules for the incentive auction. So what is channel sharing? Here's one artist's rendition that we found in the press recently, which suggests that channel sharing may be the solution to the age-old problem of who gets to decide what show we're watching tonight or who gets to hold the remote. I should assure you that this is not what we have in mind for channel sharing. We would never divide the screen vertically into two pieces that way. We think horizontally would be much better. The best starting place to discuss this topic may be the statute that gave us our incentive auction authority. We've taken to calling it the Spectrum Act because that's much easier to say than Title VI of the Middle Class Tax Relief and Job Creation Act of 2012. But they are one and the same. The President signed it into law on February 22nd, 3 months ago today. The law gives us the key authority that we need to hold an incentive auction, which we lacked under previous law, the authority to share auction proceeds with licensees who contribute spectrum to be sold in the auction. As enacted, the statute is true to the vision that we had in proposing the incentive auction idea in the broadband plan, that contributions by broadcasters to the auction will be strictly voluntary in exchange for a share of auction proceeds. The law lists three ways in which a broadcaster can offer to participate in the auction: by contributing a 6 megahertz license and taking that station off the air, by relinquishing spectrum in order to share a TV channel with one or more other licensees, or by moving from a UHF channel to a VHF channel. The idea behind channel sharing is that it can provide a way for a broadcaster to contribute spectrum to the auction, receive a capital infusion by sharing in the auction proceeds, and stay on the air and continue to serve its viewers. Channel sharing thus can help to meet the need we've identified to have more spectrum for mobile broadband service while enabling the licensee to continue to perform the important role that broadcasting.
That was the FCC, a little portion of the FCC's hearing on May 22nd channel sharing workshop. You can go to FCC.gov. for the full hearing. It's also a link at newsroom.freerunner3.9.org, and also the link to the C-SPAN video that we played earlier from Senator Grassley speaking on the U.S. Senate floor about the FCC and the LightSquared deal. Next, we're going to go to Cairo, Egypt, and Simba Rousseau from Free Speech Radio News is reporting on community radio there.
As Egyptians prepare to vote in presidential elections tomorrow, many are evaluating the uprising that led to the ouster of Hosni Mubarak. During that period, citizen journalists and community media played a key role in challenging authority, while digital media offered new ways to express views. Some of those alternative voices came from online radio stations, which have been working for years to create an informed and active population. From Cairo, Simba Rousseau has more.
The 18-day revolt that toppled former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak was organized by groups who creatively use social media and internet radio. Armed with digital audio recorders and mobile phones, people communicated information about protest routes and police brutality. Live reports from Tahrir Square offered an alternative voice to the propaganda spread by state television. The Egyptian Democratic Academy, a youth NGO aimed at fostering a culture of political participation, established its online community-run station El Marosa in 2009. The station uses community reporting to disseminate views on freedom of speech, democracy, tolerance, and human rights. Their media trainings focus on marginalized groups such as women, children, and people with disabilities. Yusuf Mohammed is the campaign and activities coordinator.
At the moment, we have three programs. One about the new media that focuses on video advocacy. We offer workshops to young people and bloggers on how to create their own radio and television channels, as well as newspapers, by showing them how to take photos and video. The Political Academy is a program about democracy, where we teach youth how to vote, their rights as citizens, how to be a politician, or how to form a political party. Another project that we initiated called Free Egyptian offers training to women on how to participate in the political life. Recently, we had a training about women in the parliament, and soon we'll have another training for activists interested in being staffers with current MPs.
A group of young journalists created Egypt's first internet radio station in 2007. With years of experience behind it, Radio Horitna offers an array of workshops on tolerance between Christians and Muslims, how to vote, and the importance of maintaining freedom of speech. Radio Horitna's editor-in-chief, Mustafa Fathi, says radio is an important means of fostering community participation.
It's hard to go to, for example, Al Masr Al Youm or Al Ahram and give them your article to publish. It is very hard here in Egypt. But Hurriyetna is open for anyone. If you have an idea, come. We will publish your article in our website. Or if you have idea for a program, we will broadcast your program live in our radio station.
One station, Banat Wabas, or Girls Only, became the region's first online radio station catering to the issues of Arab women. First established in April 2008, it now has a fan base of nearly 5 million listeners throughout the Arab world. Amani El Tunzi is the founder.
I prefer to be my message is empowering women, because we're suffering in Egypt from a lot of things as a woman and girls too, like harassment, violence, and gender equality.
Last year, watchdog group Reporters Sans Frontières moved Egypt from its internet enemies list to countries under surveillance due to the success of the country's uprisings. Again, Yusuf Mohammed.
Before and after the revolution, activists, bloggers, and radio stations were being monitored. The military council has investigated us, as well as our colleague Esra Abdel Fattah. But we moved forward, and we're not going back again. We gained our freedom, and we paid a very expensive price. And we're not going to give this away, even if we were detained, because we learned a lesson from this revolution. Many Egyptians lost their lives, their eyes, and we are using our voices for Egypt. This means that we'll do more, and we are ready to pay more if it means freedom.
Egyptians are preparing to vote in the country's first post-Mubarak presidential elections. However, with the recent crackdown by the Supreme Council of Armed Forces on several satellite channels, many say more reforms are needed, including amended media laws once the transition from military control is complete. For Free Speech Radio News, reporting from Cairo, I'm Simba Russo.
Next up, Frontline had a segment on Tuesday, May 22nd, called Cell Tower Deaths. The new world of tower climbing, pressure to get more jobs done faster can lead to dangerous practices and deadly accidents. Here's an excerpt.
People don't understand what the danger is to tower climbing. One person drops a wrench, and it'll kill somebody.
Yeah, 1,500 feet. Look at that view. We get paid for this.
The bay. 1,500 feet.
The job attracts a certain kind of worker.
This is awesome.
Someone like Jay Guilford.
He was young. He was cocky. He was never scared of nothing.
911 emergency?
Yes, we're working on a tower site. We just had a man fall from a 200-foot tower. We need an ambulance.
Okay, I'll get him in there.
It was not even a year. Jay ain't even been in it a year when the accident happened.
Guilford's death wasn't an isolated case. Over the last decade, other men have been falling to their deaths. North Carolina, Arizona, Kentucky, Florida, Iowa. Since 2003, there have been nearly 100 climbers killed on radio, TV, and cell towers, a rate that is about 10 times the average for construction workers.
Yeah, and Jay Guilford, actually, this is what he was using when he...
To find out why, reporters at Frontline and ProPublica investigated the 50 cell-related deaths.
But did they address the question of responsibility for...
After poring over thousands of documents, we discovered a complex web of subcontracting that has allowed the major carriers to avoid scrutiny when accidents happen.
I'm a lineman for the county,
and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another. I hear you singing in the wire. I can hear you through the whine. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line. I know I need a small vacation, but it don't look like rain. And if it snows, that stretch down south won't ever stand the strain. And I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line. And I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line.
You're tuned into Turn on the News, Free 103.9's daily look at radio art, radio news, media news, sound art, and more. You can go to FREE103POINT9.org, Free103.9.org, or newsroom.free103.9.org for more information about anything you hear here, including links to international sources, radio art, radio news, media news, sound art, and more. Today we first go to Chicago. Ryan Devereaux in New York is reporting for The Guardian UK that a group of independent journalists were detained at gunpoint covering the NATO summit, and he's alleging they may have been targeted. They're Tim Poole, Luke Radowski, Jeff Shively, and two friends driving to an apartment they were staying in Chicago. They were live streaming during the arrest, so they have footage of it. We've just edited one non-FCC compliant word out of the recording you're about to hear.
We're being raided right now. For those that are watching, we are being raided by the CPD as we speak.
What is this for, officers? What is this for?
I'm unbuckling my seatbelt.
We're gonna unlock it.
I got stuff in my
things. I'm putting my phone in the top.
Can you get the ground back for me?
Put your coffee down.
You want to grab this or
put it down in there?
Mine out.
Now go ahead and slide all that stuff down on the floor and step up.
Anything on you?
No, sir.
We're just pulled over. Stop, license. They didn't give us an explanation to why they're stopping us. You're watching us live right now.
12 cars. 12 cars. We're pulled over by cars. Unmarked.
Okay, we'll let that play in the background. The story shows that Poole and Radowski are among the most well-known live stream journalists covering the Occupy movement, and they've been covered in Time magazine and other places, and they are alleging that the police targeted them. Specifically, they say the afternoon that a woman renting the apartment where the group was staying allegedly informed them that the police had gathered outside of residence and were not allowing the people to enter. She reportedly advised them not to return. They said they knew who we were. They weren't pulling over a random car. Another report, though, it says that, according to Shively, a senior officer said their car matched, quote, the exact description of another vehicle that the police were looking for. So it could have been a case of mistaken identity, and I guess that's what the police are saying. Pintus, now, I remember a time when Once You Used to Love Me by the 33. Benton.org points us to a Fairleigh Dickinson University study just released. The survey's findings polled 1,185 respondents in New Jersey. So I guess it's only about how people use news sources from New Jersey. But they found that, on average, they asked a number of questions about current affairs, international and domestic, and then and also found out what people's normal source for information was. On average, people were able to answer 1.8 out of 4 questions on international news and 1.6 of 5 questions about domestic affairs. Fox News viewers could only get 1.04 domestic questions correct, and MSNBC viewers likewise did not do as well. While folks who got most of their information from NPR and the Sunday morning talk shows did pretty well and did the best, excuse me, and The Daily Show with Jon Stewart fell somewhere in between. There is an FCC Open Commission meeting May 24th at 10:30 a.m., and the FCC streams their open meetings live at fcc.gov/live. The topics at the May 24th meeting are deployable aerial communications architecture. They're examining the role of deployable aerial communications architecture in facilitating emergency response by rapidly restoring communication capabilities in the immediate aftermath of a catastrophic event. So it's a way to get an immediate airborne signal up in emergency areas, such as hurricanes. Second item is medical body area networks. It's a proposed rulemaking to establish service rules and an allocation for medical body area networks and seek comment on the selection of a coordinator for the program. The third is removing barriers to broadband deployment in the 800 megahertz band report and order. They're considering licenses with flexibility to better utilize spectrum transition networks from 2G net technologies to new more advanced networks and reusing that spectrum. That's at the FCC open meeting on May 24th. Finally, David Carr at the New York Times reports that the inventor of the wireless remote, Eugene Polly, died. See, it's not really an obituary I'm looking at, so it doesn't give the exact reason. But if you go to New York mediadecoder.blogs.newyorktimes.com, you can read David Carr's take on the wireless remote.
Yeah, I'll be coming.
As soon
have I hung up the phone.
Goodbye, Loretta.
CC with Don't Hang Up, and before that the Orlans with Don't Hang Up, and Loretta Lynn and Conway Twitty, started things off with As Soon As I Hang Up the Phone.
Turn up my radio. Turn up my radio.
Rocking my stunner shades and turning up my radio out. Turn up my radio.